From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. Proposition 1 failed last night with around 70% of voters saying no. Here are GOP primary chairman Dorothy Moon and Idaho Democratic Party chair Lauren Nekachea before the results came in.
Do you feel the energy? Do you feel that? Uh-huh, you do. So I think we're excited to see Trump win, and hopefully we defeat Prop 1.
Prop 1 is an opportunity to respond to the close Republican primary that has been spitting out far-right Republican candidates that are way out of line with what Idaho voters want.
Idahoans for open primary spokesperson Luke Mayville said despite losing, Idahoans think the close primary system is broken. The group spent more than $5 million on the campaign, but the Idaho Fair Elections PAC said that didn't, quote, deceive Idahoans into thinking that Prop 1 is good for our state, unquote. And our Attorney General, Raul Labrador, agreed with that statement.
I think in Idaho, things are going really well. As you can hear in the background, people are clapping, people are excited, people are happy. Proposition 1 is going down in a big way, and it's just a strong message that Idaho's not for sale.
So today, we've lined up a panel of reporters to break down the Idaho election results. With us today are Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, and our own Boise State Public Radio, James Dawson. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hi, Gemma.
Hello.
So let's begin, panel, with Prop 1 and what it would have done if passed. Clark, let's start with you on that.
Yeah, thanks, Gemma, for having me on. I sure appreciate it. Prop 1 would have made changes to primary elections and general elections in the state of Idaho. It kind of would have completely remade our election process. First, for the primary election, one of the big changes it would have made is it would have repealed Idaho's closed party primary law that the legislature put in place in 2011. And instead of closed party primary laws, where voters are not allowed to vote if they are not a member affiliated with a political party. Instead of that, Proposition 1 would have created a new system of primary elections that was open to all candidates and all voters, regardless of party affiliation. And then the four candidates in that primary election who received the most votes would have all advance to the general election, again, regardless of party affiliation. The second big change that Proposition 1 would have made applied to the general election. And instead of the current general election system that we have in Idaho, it would have created something called ranked choice voting, which is also called an instant runoff system in some areas. And what that would have done is Idahoans would have still selected their favorite candidate from those four candidates that advanced from the primary, and then they would have had the option to rank the remaining candidates in order of preference, second choice, third choice, and fourth choice. But that would have been an option. They would have not had to rank all of the candidates on the ballot if they didn't want to. And then it would get into the instant runoff component, where the candidate with the fewest votes in the general election would have been eliminated. And then the eliminated candidate's votes would have been transferred to the next highest ranked active remaining candidate in the field. That process would continue until there were two candidates left and the candidate with the most votes would have won. Those were the two big changes that Proposition would have made to change and reform Idaho's elections, Gemma.
And Jimmy, so what happens now with Idaho's primary system? Does it stay exactly the same?
Yeah, that's right. Unless the legislature chooses to make any changes for whatever reason in the upcoming legislative session or in future years. You know, theoretically, they could go do another ballot initiative and just stick with an open primary component of it, as opposed to the ranked choice voting, which, by the way, across the country, several states also rejected those, and Alaska repealed its ranked choice voting system as well. So very unpopular across the country, you know, is what we saw last night.
Kevin, you noted the margin of victory on this proposition was pretty stunning.
Yeah, I think that's the surprise from Tuesday night. It's not so much the Prop 1 lost. I'm not terribly surprised by that. But we're talking about almost 70% of voters rejected Prop 1. And I I love looking at recent history in the context of the history that preceded. I mean, you go back to 2012, and you go back to the three propositions, the three referenda we had on, well, whether you want to call it Students Come First or the Luna laws, the three education laws. All three of those were rejected fairly handily. The most lopsided of the three was the so-called laptop law, the one that would have provided every high school kid with a laptop. That failed with about 66.7% opposition. So Prop 1 is doing even worse, or did even worse than the laptop law, which is a pretty dubious achievement in political context.
Yeah, if you look at it, they're still counting ballots in a couple of counties as of when the show started, but just a small number. But Proposition 1 is failing in 43 of Idaho's 44 counties, Gemma and Kevin. I just thought that that was interesting and illustrative.
What was the outlier, Clark? I'm just curious.
Blaine County, which is actually one of the counties where we believe they're still counting votes. But yes, Blaine County is the only Idaho county where Proposition 1 is passing as of right now out of the 44 counties there, everyone.
Yeah, I knew they weren't done in Blaine County. So, okay, I was curious.
So, Scott, Jimmy mentioned that ranked choice voting just was not popular across the country. So before we go to break, you have a roundup of those bills in other states.
Yeah, Idaho is not alone. Like Jimmy said, Alaska had ranked choice voting on its ballot to repeal it. And it, as of now, it looks like it is indeed being repealed. But Oregon had ranked choice voting on the ballot, and that that was being rejected by 60% of Oregon voters. Colorado, 55% were rejecting it. Nevada, 54% of voters there were rejecting it. And Missouri had a constitutional amendment to prohibit ranked choice voting, and that was passing with 68% of the vote. The only place to support ranked choice voting appears to be Washington, D.C. For its city elections with 72% of the vote. So like Jimmy said, it was all across the country. It was a bad day for ranked choice voting supporters.
So no surprise that the GOP will still hold a supermajority in the Idaho legislature. However, there were some races to watch last night. So let's turn back to Republican Party Chairman Dorothy Moon and Democratic Party Chair Lauren Nekacheya to find out what they were watching.
Legislative District 6 and Dan Foreman. I'm also watching Legislative District 15 with our three ladies, Dory Healy and Annette Tipton, and also Cody Galloway. They're fighting for those seats. And down in Bannock County, we have Dustin Manwaring, who's in a little bit of a fight down there in Bannock. So well, I'm watching those pretty close.
You know, those battleground districts matter so much because Republicans control 82% of the legislature, and so we have that lack of balance, but we do see this, there's a tug of war between traditional Republicans and the extreme far right that would, you know, defund major state agencies tomorrow if they could. They would defund Medicaid if they could. And so the Democratic caucus really makes a difference.
So I know all of you were watching races closely last night as well. So Jimmy, let me start the conversation with you because I know you've been keeping your eye on District 15. So tell us about that race and what happened last night.
Boy, yeah. District 15, for those who aren't familiar, is West Boise. And this has been a district for the last several cycles where seats are ping-ponging back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. Before last night, you had a Democratic senator, you had a Democratic representative, and a Republican representative. After last night, these are unofficial results, but Senator Rick Just, the Democratic incumbent in the Senate, seemingly lost his race to Cody Galloway, meaning that, you know, now there's a Republican majority in West Boise. Democrat Representative Steve Birch barely hung on by a couple hundred votes, which were added very late last night. Even when I left here at 2:30 in the morning, it showed him losing, but he managed to scrape that one together. And it was just another, you know, night where it was really great to be a Republican in Idaho and terrible to be a Democrat in Idaho.
So, Clark and Kevin, I know both of you were watching other legislative races that were close. So, Clark, I'll start with you, but Kevin, feel free to hop in.
Yeah, for sure. As part of the red wave that we saw across the country that obviously continued into Idaho last night, I think in all of the so-called swing legislative districts that the reporters on this show and other reporters identified, other than Democrat Steve Burch appearing to retain his seat in District 15. Like Jimmy just mentioned, Republicans took all of the other swing districts that had been identified or are at least leading right now with a very, very small percentage of the vote still to be counted. The way I have things scored is that Republicans are poised to increase their supermajority in the Idaho legislature by a total of 4 seats, I think 2 each, in the Idaho House and the Idaho Senate both. And if these numbers hold through the final ballots being counted today and then hold through the official canvass on November 26th, which is when the votes actually become certified and official, this will be one of the largest supermajorities in modern history in the Idaho legislature since we went to our current configuration of legislative districts. You have to go all the way back to 2001 to have a more robust Republican supermajority than they're posed to have in 2025. The way I have it is right now, the balance of power is 87-18 Republicans overall. And if these election results hold, that would increase for 2025 to a 91-14 advantage for the Republicans. That could mean Democrats losing even more of the slim amount of influence that they did have in the state house in Boise. We're going to be watching closely when the legislature reconvenes for an organizational session in just about a month to vote on leadership races and committee assignments. But it could be a much more conservative and more powerful legislature, Jimma, than we've really seen. Just this morning, Citizens Committee approved a large pay increase for legislators. And as we know, 2 years ago, Idaho voters approved a ballot measure that allows the Idaho legislature to call itself back into session, even without the governor doing so. So the big picture is the Republican supermajority in the Idaho legislature is increasing to near historic levels for the state of Idaho. And this is coming at a time as the legislature has been consolidating and consciously trying to increases power. So I know we'll all be watching closely the committee assignments and then the upcoming 2025 legislative session that kicks off in just about 9 weeks or so, Jimma.
And Kevin, your thoughts on, yeah.
A couple things jumped out at me about this, Jimma. I mean, first of all, we shouldn't be terribly surprised that Democrats lost seats in the legislature on Tuesday night. It's really difficult for Democrats to gain ground in legislative elections in a presidential election year. The turnout is higher. It's an energized Republican electorate coming out to the polls. I went back and looked only once since 1969. And no, Clark, I was not covering the 1969 legislature, so don't even go there. Only once since 1969 have Democrats gained legislative seats in a presidential election year. That was 1988. So this isn't terribly surprising, except that the Democrats really prided themselves on recruiting candidates, filling ballot spots to a much greater degree than they had in the past. So this can't go over well. This has to be kind of a bitter pill for Democrats. The geography of this, Jimma, is stunning. If these results hold, and Clark mentioned that we're still waiting on some results in District 26, we're still waiting on some final numbers in District 26, that is the Blaine, Lincoln, Jerome County Legislative District. If those results hold, all but one legislator, a Democratic legislator in the state, will live in Pocatello. There will be only one outside of outside of Boise, and that's James Rigby, the senator from Pocatello, who was running unopposed on Tuesday. You have virtually, literally wiped Democratic legislators off the map, save for Boise, if these results hold. And it's really kind of a historic thing. I mean, Blaine County, we talked about, you know, we're still waiting on some results from there. There's been a legislator, a Democratic legislator from Blaine County every session for at least the past 40 years, as far back as I can piece it together this morning. This is, right now the Democrats are kind of relegated to a handful of blue districts in Boise. And beyond that, it's, you know, tough sledding. I wonder how this party recovers and moves forward in 26, a non-presidential year when theoretically the headwinds might not be as strong against Democratic candidates. But rough night for Idaho Democrats.
Yeah, and in fact, we talked to District 15 Representative Steve Birch last night, and he talked about how he's worried about that exact balance of power in the legislature. So let's take a listen.
The fact is that if you're going to make good decisions, you need to have a broad range of thinking. Any time any one group of people can make total control without, you know, of government, they wind up ignoring what they don't want to hear. And you wind up taking voters for granted.
So, Scott, I'm curious now, when we see such this shift, right, as Kevin just mentioned, save for one lone Democrat over in East Idaho, the Democrats are in Boise, not surprising. But with that said, how will fewer Democrats in the legislature affect things like the abortion ban or school vouchers, even things like allowing guns in schools?
Right. I mean, this is less about the Democratic Party than kind of the makeup of the legislature as a whole, because if you think about it, you've always had extremist legislators in the legislature, and they try to pass bills that are extreme. And what you end up having is you have the centrist or moderate wing of the Republican Party pushing back against them, but they can't really do that without Democrats voting with them as well. So if you look at some of these votes, and some of these votes are very close, 36, 34, or 37, 32, or 33, those with a reduction in the number of Democrats and an increase in the number of extremist legislators, that balance of power very well may tip in the upcoming session. And like Clark pointed out, the next big thing is that those December organizational meetings where we see who the leadership is. You know, Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winder was voted out of office by a more extreme candidate, and he will not be in that leadership role. And so who will be the Senate President Pro Tem, and who will be making up those committees, and what bills will be coming forward, and which bills will be shot down, and with fewer Democrats forming a coalition with centrist Republicans, there may be a more extremist tilt in the state legislature for such things like, you know, we can forget about fixing the abortion ban, but school vouchers is going to come up, guns in schools, Medicaid expansion repeal may come up, a whole host of issues.
Idaho launch.
Yeah.
Which has been on a knife's edge for two sessions. It'll be really interesting to see what happens with that.
And another thing to think about, too, is not just these issues themselves, but also committee makeups. I mean, we saw House Speaker Mike Moyle take a Democrat off of JFAC because they had lost, a seat in that House race, a couple years ago. And he said, you know, proportionally, this makes sense. And so I could totally imagine, the committees with a couple Democrats on there, not only for proportional reasons, but also just straight up workload. I mean, if you're going to have maybe 9 Democrats only in the House of Representatives, you know, there are several committees and they meet all week. So just from a workload standpoint, it's also a big bear there.
Mm-hmm. So Jimmy, with that said, are there certain committees that have to have Republicans and Democrats on them in the legislature?
Well, I would assume that they would have to have at least one Democrat on there, but there's only one committee in the entire legislature that has equal representation, and that's JLOC, which is basically oversees and directs the Office of Performance Evaluation to look into special investigations, basically the legislature's independent watchdog unit, which has been kind of under attack by top legislative leaders in the past several years, wanting to defund them or transfer employees out. And this is like the committee that has, you know, shed light on several key issues, such as like death reports. I'm thinking the like Medicaid expansion prior to Medicaid expansion, and just how many people fell through the cracks there. People who are aging in place or reliant on other government services, all kinds of different things there.
And Jimmy, what about the committee like JFAC? And if there is just all Republicans on that, that could potentially happen. Yes. And what could we then see? I mean, because they're the ones who, you know, approve who gets how much money.
Well, I would imagine, again, that there would be at least one Democrat, which is what you have in the House. There are two Democratic senators on there at the current moment. But, you know, if the new Senate pro tem chooses to go the way of Mike Moyle, then potentially that extra seat could be cut. Yes, you would lose not only that advocate for certain positions, or, you know, just an extra vote against or for something, just a whole lot of repercussions that could have significant consequences.
And I
let's
think
take
Jimmy's
a quick break. Go ahead, Clark.
I think Jimmy's exactly right. And when you talk about there's only two Democrats in the Senate on JFAC, one of those is Senator Rick Just of Boise, who appears to have lost his reelection bid. And so I think that there will be big changes coming to JFAC. Sorry to jump in. I thought Jimmy made a really good point. I just wanted to point out that one of those two seats on JFAC was held by a Democrat who lost today.
No, appreciate that, Clark. So there was much anxiety around yesterday's election. In fact, here's Idaho House Speaker Mike Moyle.
This election's been different than past elections because there's been so much, people are anxious. There's this anxiety nationally in the state of Idaho both. And I think that people just, I mean, they're anxious. They want to get this done. They want to know, right? And so I think there's more anxiety this time around and excitement at the same time.
Well, Moyle can relax. He was reelected, as were a lot of members of the Republican Party last night. However, there were other things on the ballot that we need to talk about, one being school bonds, because this impacts so many Idahoans. So, Kevin, I want to turn to you on this. Can you run down some of those school bonds and levies for us? Because I believe there was something like, what, $244 million at stake?
Well, we reviewed the math, and it's actually even higher than that. It was $259 million. That's a lot of money, obviously, and it was kind of a low-key, important election night for schools, because we've not seen this money, bonds and levies, on a November ballot. And the reason we're seeing that now is because the legislature over the past couple of years has kind of dismantled the school elections options. You can't run a bond or a levy in March or August like you used to be able to. So now schools have to run these in either May or November. So that's why you saw so many bonds and levies on the ballot in November. On Tuesday, most of the supplemental levies passed. There were 24 on the ballot statewide, 21 of them passed. Four districts were looking for plant facilities levies, which are, you know, kind of used for building upkeep. All four of those passed. The two bond issues failed, and the biggest bond issue of the bunch, and really the biggest ballot measure of them all, was a bond issue in Soda Springs. That failed. Bond issues are tough to pass because they need a two-thirds supermajority whenever you run them. So not terribly surprising that the bonds ran into some difficulty. But by and large, like I say, the supplemental levies and the plant facilities levies did pass. They did get the support that they needed.
So, Kevin, what does that say to you? I know, because you report so deeply on education in the state. And as you mentioned, bonds are definitely difficult to pass, but levies historically have been difficult to pass as well.
Levies have been a lot easier to pass simply because of the math. You only need a simple majority to pass a supplement levy. So overwhelmingly, these levies have passed when they were on the ballot in March and August, when they were kind of standalone elections. Mm-hmm. So we really didn't know exactly what to expect when these levies were on the ballot in November, alongside a presidential race, alongside legislative races, alongside Proposition 1 in this case, didn't really know what we were going to see. And what we saw, like I say, 21 out of 24 passed. The only three that failed were up in the panhandle. So, yeah, I don't know what that means long term. You know, I don't want to read too much into one election result, but for most school officials, they're waking up Wednesday relieved or pleased that they got their ballot measures through.
Yeah. So, Scott, let's head to Ada County, in particular the Ada County Highway District, because Rebecca Arnold tried to get her seat back. She lost, though, to current President Alexis Pickering. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is a really interesting race, because 4 years ago, Alexis Pickering had unseated Rebecca Arnold. Rebecca Arnold had been on the Ada County Highway District for 16 years. And Alexis Pickering, a newcomer, a young new face to politics, beat her by four votes in 2020. Rebecca Arnold subsequently ran for and won the county assessor seat, and she's been the county assessor for the past 2 years, and then threw her hat in the ring to run a rematch against Alexis Pickering. And I think a lot of us, just as many people were surprised that the Prop 1 failed by so much, I think a lot of people were surprised that this race between Alexis Pickering and Rebecca Arnold was not nearly as close. I think a lot of people were expecting another kind of nail biter, maybe not by four votes, but closer than it turned out. Alexis Pickering defeated Rebecca Arnold by more than 4,000 votes this time around. So a much more definitive race. In the other race for Ada County Highway District, Patricia Nielsen won by a landslide to replace Jim Hansen. And Alexis Pickering and Jim Hansen were perhaps more progressive on the commission. And Patricia Nielsen is probably more progressive. She's a land use planner, former Canyon County planning director, and really knows her stuff, and is perhaps maybe more multimodal focused than just build more roads. So the makeup of the Ada County Highway District Commission it is pretty much staying the same, and maybe with a little more expertise with Patricia Nielsen in the land use planning sphere. Dave McKinney, who is more of a maybe road-centric commissioner, he ran unopposed and kept his seat.
And then, Scott, quickly, what about the Ada County Commission races that were up for grabs?
Yeah, I don't think there were too many surprises here. Both incumbents Ryan Davidson and Tom Daly, they kept their seats on the commission with something like, if I can get to it, 60% of the vote or 64% of the vote. I can't find my numbers right now. But they won pretty handily over their Democratic challengers, Jonathan Lashley and Devin Gutierrez. Not much of a surprise, but that keeps the Ada County Commission as a Republican, all Republican makeup.
So I'm curious, what else caught all of your eyes yesterday that may impact Idaho moving forward in the future? And I'll just go down the list. So Clark, I want to start with you. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the voter turnout, we're still counting the votes, but it's looking like the most voters in Idaho history voted in this election, not percentage, but just raw numbers. And that sort of makes sense, right? It's a presidential election. Idaho continues to be a fast moving state, but it's looking like about 905,000 Idahoans cast votes. And I remember just over a year ago when Idaho surpassed 1 million registered voters, there were we're not at 90%. It's going to be less than that because we had a lot of election day registrations. But the number of voters who turned out, and then the early voting and absentee totals, something like 35% of registered voters had already voted before election day. I talked to Phil McGrane, Idaho Secretary of State, about that last night at about 11 o'clock. And he said that the biggest takeaway for him was the increase in early in-person voting, which happened across the state, across political demographics. And so I don't know what it means yet, other than people are comfortable with early voting. But I don't know how it affects the political landscape moving forward, other than just a massive turnout. Percentage will fall just short of 2020, it looks like, which is the record. But a massive voter turnout, Gemma, is what caught my eye.
Jimmy, what about you?
Yeah, I was kind of curious just to see whether or not Ada County would actually back a Democratic presidential candidate. You know, it's something that hasn't happened, at least in Idaho, since 1964 with LBJ. If you look at 2020, current President Joe Biden got about 46.4% of the vote compared to Trump's 50.3%. But if you look at Ada County's results right now, Kamala Harris actually lost votes. She lost about 4,000 votes. She came in with 4,000 fewer than Joe Biden did 4 years ago. And then Donald Trump added an extra 13,000 votes onto his total. So it doesn't surely doesn't seem like Ada County is going to go blue anytime soon as far as presidential races go.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, what caught your eye yesterday?
You know, I was looking at the first congressional district. This is Russ Fulcher's seat. And Kayleigh Peterson, the Democratic challenger, she said that she was going to run three times at least against Fulcher. This is her second run at the seat. And, you know, we talked to her before the election. She said, look, we're realistic about whether we can actually win this seat. But really, mm-hmm. we're looking for improvement. And she really did not have improvement. She actually went down in her percentage from 2 years ago. And the percentage from 4 years ago, when Rudy Soto 4 years ago in the last presidential election, he had almost 29% of the vote in the first congressional district. And this time around, Kayleigh Peterson received only 25% of the vote, about 15,000 fewer, 16,000 fewer voters in that first congressional district. So the first congressional district seems to be getting a darker shade of red. And Russ Fulcher seems to have a very tight lock on that. And I wonder if we'll see Kayleigh Peterson run for that third time 2 years from now.
And Kevin, let me wrap up with you. What stood out to you last night?
Well, I just want to quick call attention to nonpartisan races that definitely had political and partisan overtones. Three trustee races in Kootenai County for seats on the North Idaho College Board of Trustees. Slate of candidates supported by a more moderate mainstream group that calls itself Save NIC. All three of those candidates won. They defeated three candidates, including an incumbent, who were backed by the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee. This is an interesting election, and it's a significant election because, as we've talked about on the show a lot over the past couple of years, North Idaho College has had a lot of issues regarding governance, regarding dysfunction and discord on that board of trustees. They're still under the cloud of potential loss of accreditation, which would have severe impacts on the college. So those are some pretty significant election results that, even though it's 500 miles away from where we are, pretty significant. Our new North Idaho reporter, Emma Epperly, has a full story about that if you want more details about what happened up there.
So let's continue our election coverage as well as our analysis. So joining us now is Mickey Cunningham, constitutional scholar and graduate professor at the College of Idaho. Nice to have you on the show, McKay.
Hi, Gemma.
So we want to dive into both Prop 1 just for a moment. And I want to turn once again to Republican Party Chairman Dorothy Moon, as well as Democratic Party Chair Lauren Nekacheya, who spoke last night.
I'm feeling great. I think we're going to defeat this Proposition 1.
Prop 1 is an opportunity not candidates, I don't think, of a different partisan mix. I don't think we would elect more Democrats under Prop 1. But we would get more consensus candidates that more closely align with the voters of their district.
So Prop 1 failed. And McKay, my question is this. There was a recent Boise State University poll that found support for an open primary, but not for ranked choice voting. So before we get into the ramifications of the presidential election, I'm curious to know, do you believe Prop 1 would have passed if it had just been about open primaries?
Thanks, Jim. I think that's a hard question to speculate on, but I'll still give an answer. I mean, I did see some polling as well about 2 weeks prior to the election, in which it appeared to show that there was about 50%, maybe 51% in favor of open primaries and not nearly as much with regard to ranked choice voting. So I've seen that same data, but I would still say that if it was just open primaries, it would have failed last night. I would have said that for three reasons. One is that the Idaho Republican Party really coalesced here in opposition to open primaries and ranked choice voting. I think they would have done so again if it was just open primaries. And one of the reasons is that, look, the Idaho Republican Party, as we stand right now under Idaho statute, can unilaterally on their own open up their primaries if they want to. And there's absolutely no movement that I have seen to go in that direction by the Idaho Republican Party. And the third reason is really by analogy. And we look at Arizona, and Arizona is not nearly as red as Idaho. They have a much better balance, if you will, between Republicans and Democrats. And on their ballot, they had an initiative that just included open primaries. It did not include a ranked choice voting aspect to it. And it failed. And it failed by a pretty big margin of 57.9%.
So let's talk about the presidential election. So many eyes were on that election last night and the results of that. And I want to really dive in, McKay, to some of the potential ramifications for Idaho stemming from both the presidential election, but also Idaho State House results. So let's begin with former President Trump, soon to be President Trump's promise that he made on day one of mass deportation of immigrants. If he were to follow through with that, if he had the ability to do that, how would this impact our state's agriculture and construction industries?
Oh, wow. Yes. Quite a lot was said on the campaign trail about closing the border, about mass deportations, to, quote, put these vicious and bloodthirsty criminals in jail. And it may be more rhetoric and bluster than actual policy that is implemented on day one, but it would be foolhardy to just dismiss it as such. So if you look at some of the economic effects of mass deportation, just the cost alone to deport undocumented immigrants has been estimated by the American Immigration Council to be about $88 billion a year to deport only 1 million of our about 12 to 13 million undocumented immigrants. And that just leaves also that secondary economic effect. What happens when all of these immigrants are deported from the United States? How will that affect the U.S. labor market, the food supply, and particularly in Idaho, how will it affect our ag industry? Like you say, and when you look at some of the data, it's pretty interesting. With regard to agriculture, you would lose one in eight workers. And we already have a labor shortage with regard to agricultural workers in Idaho. And if you dig even deeper into dairy, Gemma, which you know in Idaho is a very big industry, in dairy in Idaho today, 90% of those working in dairy jobs are foreign born. So again, logistically, it's unlikely that the incoming administration will be able to deport a million people in 1 year, et cetera. It would be folly, however, to ignore the economic impacts, particularly with regard to industries that are very important in Idaho, including agriculture, construction, hospitality, and milk.
Well, and McKay, when we really dig into this, right? I mean, let's take dairy, for example. That's milk. You buy it at the grocery store. We have heard numerous complaints across the country about inflation. We've seen inflation. We've seen grocery prices go up. We've seen milk prices go up. If there is a deportation, that is going to impact what you pay for milk at the grocery store. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it's a fair statement. And you don't have to take my word for it. The National Milk Producers Federation, they said, look, if we don't have immigrant workers in our industry, milk prices will spike dramatically. They peg the economic cost of something like taking away immigrant workers to something around $32 billion. So yeah, Jim, I think if this happens, and that's, again, a big if, this could just be campaign rhetoric, but if it does happen, there will be effects like that aren't just limited to milk, where a lot of seemingly or typically inexpensive items will be very, very expensive.
And another thing, McKay, is I think there's a misunderstanding of undocumented immigrants paying taxes. We also heard about that. In 2022, undocumented immigrants in the United States paid $96.7 billion in federal, state, and local taxes. So you even have a tax base that would be going away.
No doubt. There's a raft of studies that are really hard to refute, suggesting that immigrants year over year grow our economy and nothing else. And there's no drag on the economy, but there's a growth on our economy because of immigrant labor.
So I want to switch to the Idaho legislature now, because last session, we really saw a push towards school choice. Some people call it school vouchers, school choice. Basically, it is that the money follows the child, right? Whether they are in public school or private school. How do you think that this new, I guess, extra supermajority could potentially impact that move to educational vouchers? And frankly, a move toward private schools that, by the way, public vouchers don't cover the entire cost of that.
Your previous panel did a great job of explaining yesterday's election results as it relates to the Idaho legislature. I think it's also important to kind of rewind the clock 2 years ago to the primary. And generally speaking, in the Republican primary, Republicans who favored a school voucher or school choice, they were reelected. Republican incumbents, who opposed school choice or vouchers for private schools and kids were defeated, were unseated, were kicked out of office. And so we have a legislature that is not only stronger with regard to Republicans versus Democrats, that's 91-14, but we also have a legislature that is more predisposed, at least the way that I read it, to favor a bill like you talked about, a bill that would take public dollars and give them to private schools in whatever form, whether it's a voucher or to their parents or to the school itself. So I think it would probably be likely that we will see that legislation again, and even more likely than last session that it would pass.
Mm-hmm. I have 2 minutes left with you, McKay. I do want to talk about the makeup in the legislature in regards to women's reproductive health. This is something that I think many women, men as well, but many women across the country, and we saw even with certain states passing access to abortion care, this is something that is on top of mind.
Yeah, I mean, Jim, we need more than 2 minutes.
I know.
I think it's really curious what happened this election cycle, in the sense that we had a presidential election that was very clear on this point, that Trump was responsible and claimed responsibility for overturning Roe versus Wade. And Harris was on the other end of that spectrum. And yet it didn't make much of an influence, at least as far as I can see, with regard to the presidential election. On the other hand, there were several states, several voter initiatives across the United States on a state-by-state basis in which reproductive rights definitely won. In Arizona, in Colorado, in Missouri and Montana, both red states, initiatives passed protecting reproductive rights, allowing abortions in a lot of different circumstances. Same for New York, same for Nevada. The only two states that failed to increase women's reproductive rights with regard to this question appear to be South Dakota and Florida. But overall, it was a very big win as it relates to abortion initiatives on a state-by-state basis.
Mm-hmm. And we should note that in the state of Florida, they have to get a 60% majority. They had 57%. So majority still wanted it, but per Florida law, did not pass based on that 60%. McKay, we are out of time. So appreciate you. I know we'll have you back to talk more in depth about all of these issues as we move forward for the remainder of the year and into the new legislative session come 2025.